I'm James.
I'm Carrie.
I'm Lacey.
And I'm Lee at Just One More Fix,
a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in three, two, one.
Hello, and I'm Annika Wills, and I played Polly in Doctor Who in 1966, and you are listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 256 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we put our studio inside the studio of another Doctor Who podcast, only to find that they put their podcast inside ours. And, well, it's sort of like a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. Two great tastes that are still just a giant cluster of dorks together. Is that extra peanuts?
Chunky.
I'm your host, Haley Malley.
And I am Keir Hansen. This week, we are going to revel in the agony and the ecstasy of what is the six-episode Atlantean temporal bender known as the Time Monster, fifth story of the ninth season. At the pen of Robert Sloman, whom we last heard from in The Daemons, we've got a script full of some of the best phrases you're going to get from the Third Doctor era, some wild swings at marginally plausible theoretical physics, our expected quota of horrible wigs. In fact, I think we exceed the quota this time around. One of the masteriest masters you could hope for, Roger Delgado, just killing it, chewing up scenery like it's got buffalo wing sauce on it. Oh, and a cat. You got a cat on screen. And you know that, you know, by our rules, cat on screen,
everyone,
you got to drink. Everyone drinks. So joining us for the discussion this week are the twin galactic arms of the Mutter Spiral podcast itself, John O'Connor and Will York. Gentlemen, welcome to GPR.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great pleasure and looking forward to talking about this with you.
Yeah, so let's just kind of dive right into this here. We always like to go around the horn and try and see who's rewatching versus seeing for the first time. Haley, it's pretty much a given. We're just going to take that as read. But for you two gentlemen, is the Time Monster familiar to either of you?
It is to me. I've seen it several times. This is probably the first time I've seen it. Definitely this century, you know, probably 30 years ago. You know, I had it on, had gotten it on VHS tape and things like that, and then seen it on the DVD. But it was fun watching it again, but I'd definitely seen it before.
Okay, John?
And for me, this is my very first time watching this. I missed huge swaths of the Third Doctor era, and this is one of those stories that I just somehow missed. I actually did see the mutants, but somehow never saw the Time Monster. So this was entirely a brand new experience, question mark?
Okay. All right. I will take your question mark, and we'll start to kind of dissolve that a little bit, because this is one, as I sort of alluded to, we sort of treat this like an agony and ecstasy. This is one where it almost at times can fall into the category of so bad it's good.
Yes.
But but I will posit that there are some genuinely very good things in this story as well. I don't want to throw my opinion around too much because I really want to pick everybody's brain on this. But as far as the things that you would consider to be some of the genuine positive takeaways, whether it be from character portrayal to their plot elements to, I'm not even going to say their effects or whatever, but whatever it is. I mean, what were the ones that, what were the elements of it where you sat back and said, you know what, that, okay, all right, this is kind of a rewarding little thing, either on a rewatch or viewing it for the first time.
Well, my usual complaint about these classic episodes that are more than four parts is that it should have been four parts, because mm-hmm. usually when you get to like six-part stories, it's like, two of those episodes were repeats of two episodes that we already saw. I do not think that was the case with this one. Like, they did something different with every episode. They didn't rehash the same bits of story over and over again as much as others that we've seen.
Let me throw something back at you on that, though.
Okay.
So even though it doesn't seem like they took scenes and sort of rehashed them or in time at times actually just reran footage that they had already shot, which, you know, they've been wont to do. Did you feel, though, that there were segments here within any of the episodes that just weren't really necessary? Or did you feel that it all kind of had a nice, everything had its function, a place for everything and everything in its place?
Hmm. Well, I think somewhere around it, was it episode two or three? I think episode three, where the Doctor is putting together his time interrupter out of a corkscrew and corks. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time is taken up with that just so that the Master can flip the switch and stop it. That seemed to eat up a lot of time for no particular reason whatsoever. I agree that there was not a lot of repeat in this one. It did seem there was a lot of time wasted on this one, particularly in the middle part of around about episode three or four, I would say.
I'm just happy that they're wasting it in different ways each time. Mm-hmm. We've had episodes before where it's like, okay, everybody put their guns down. And then the next episode, the other side does the same thing. And then it switches back. Everyone put your guns down. And,
right. That's true.
The Doctor put together a pile of crap for no reason. But, you know, the Doctor has to play with a pile of crap every once in a while.
And they definitely had some bits of, like you said, besides sort of reusing some of the footage with, like, you know, getting the Brigadier stuck. And we look back out there and they're still frozen towards the end. But in the same, when the Doctor was putting together his, putting together the great wine bottle experiment, it seemed like he did, like, let's all run to Stewart's room because he's 80 years old now. And then let's all go back to the lab. Mm-hmm. Now let's all go back to Stewart's room. You know, so it's like a whole lot of, you know, herd moving back and forth. But I mean, I guess that's just part of the nature of what you had to do with, because they had so many, which is one of the things I really like, so many different characters they had to service in this, both in the modern day period and then, obviously, and then later on, once they got to Atlantis, there are lots of moving pieces.
Well, that's a great point to sort of dive into a little bit. As far as the characters, we always run into a little bit of a concern with some of the stories that there are either characters that were really not necessary to move things forward, or they were there just to give a handful of lines because it didn't quite work to have it conveyed by, you know, one of our principals or what have you. I don't know necessarily personally that we have any real throwaway characters here. Everybody's got a pretty clear function. Maybe the Minotaur. I don't know. But from the jump, you know, episodes one and two with Stu and Ruth. I mean, all right. I'm gonna just pause everything right now and say Ruth is the best.
I love Ruth.
Goddamn character they've put in Classic Who. In ages. I just love her to death. I just wish they did more with her.
I think they should bring her back in the next season of Doctor Who as just like this old crotchety scientist running her own lab.
Fine.
Yeah, I agree. I thought she was great. Yet I thought she really added a lot to the scene and held her own when she's acting with, you know, John Pertwee, Roger Delgado, and especially in those early scenes. So I thought she did a fantastic job as an actress and as a role. I thought it was great.
Yeah, it was really nice too interesting how they had her being, you know, she was just giving everyone, you know, the stick about everything. You know, Stu, I thought you were being some sort of tough big man and getting on, you know, Professor Thaskalis for talking down to her and stuff. And while that's obviously very much of the time, you know, it's still unfortunately something that resonates to this day, but it was great, you know, that still happens. But yeah, she was awesome. She's one of those characters. I'm sure Caroline Chan is probably sitting at home going, they could have done that more with Liz Shaw.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
She was really terrific.
That may have been just a matter of sort of testing the waters, but I'm glad to see that Letts and Dix and allowing Sloman's script to stand as strong on emerging feminism as it did, that they said, nope, you know what, just keep it in there. I mean, this is a sign of the times. This is part of the current conversation, and it would be unusual not to have it in there, especially with a character of her stature, you know, of where she stands within the university and her role within these experiments. I love the fact that when she's kind of throwing it back at the professor, he kowtows. You get to wonder how genuine it is or how much he's just, you know, seeing her as any other foolish human that's beneath him anyway, but it makes for some really engaging start to this story. You know, I finish episode one, I get on episode two, and I've seen it a couple times. I'm still loving to see where it goes. My earlier question, though, about the material and whether there's, you know, is everything necessary? Does everything have, you know, have its own little shelf that it needs to fit upon? I want to say that this story follows a bit of a bell curve, an inverse bell curve. It troughs a little bit in episodes 3 and 4 and then comes back strong in 5 and 6. But that's just my personal take. And I think it's not necessarily due to pacing. It may just be because they have to move some aspects of this transition from present back to Atlantis. And you need some of that glue, and the glue is not always the most fascinating part of it.
But how tense was it when we thought Yates had died?
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of cool to see Benton, you know, getting the fact that it's funny because as I was watching it again, it's been long enough that when he takes the telephone call from the master pretending to be the brigadier and he gives him the "my dear fellow" and obviously I tripped that I remember I was like, Benton, I'd forgotten that Benton doesn't fall for them. Like, Benton shouldn't fall for that. That's obvious. And sure enough, he, you know, trips it right away. So it's kind of nice that in sort of doing that, and like you said, kind of having to set up and move some of the pieces in place for getting it to Atlantis, they still had some nice bits in there like that. Mm. As well.
Do you think when they finished that call, they ordered a bunch of pizzas on the credit card?
I would have followed up because one of the things I really loved about this story, even though I have serious questions about the overall plot, is the character moments on this, especially with the Doctor and Joe and that wonderful scene towards the end. And how the master interacts and sort of starts losing control as things go along and how he portrays that. But, you know, UNIT tends to be, you know, at least stereotypically in my mind, looking back on it, is sort of not quite comic relief, but always like second rate. And here I think they really show, you know, everyone has a moment of being able to shine. And, you know, Benson was always my favorite. And this sort of moment with him is really fantastic.
I will say they did. The Brig still comes out of this one a little bit on the silly side. I think they give him the majority of the opportunities to be the whole, well, you cad, you, and kind of, you know, play that role, especially, you know, God, they give him the, you know, the closing lines there that just makes it kind of silly to begin with. And poor Benton. Not poor Benton at all. I'm going to, you know, Levine he still talks about that to this day. I mean, that's one of his crowning achievements, is to be able to stand there in the buff with his, you know, with his butt to the camera. Although I will say that as far as our character representation, some of our supporting characters, take us through the Atlanteans to a certain degree, because I think there was something where there could have been a little bit more. Specifically, I got hints, and I keep, every time I go back to this, I keep watching the scene between Galea and Hippias, and their relationship that was somewhere in the past, and I kept wanting to. I think I put this obviously a little bit more on Aidan Murphy as Hippias, that he didn't quite sell it. as much as they could have about, you know, the, you know, I knew you when, and, you know, you're not the same, you know, the same woman I fell in love with. But am I picking up on a familiar vibe here?
Oh yeah, I definitely felt that. And I thought the scene was actually really good. And that's one of those kind of scenes that it would have been easy to be lost in the, you know, in the, well, we've got to service kind of the plot and, you know, the more main characters, and to sort of throw that in there to sort of hint at what was there before, because it's, I was sort of getting it in my memory from some of the stuff Galea was saying. But then when they, you know, came in and had that, you know, real face to face, I thought he was fine. I mean, Ingrid Pitt was awesome.
But
I thought that was a really neat scene and added a lot to it, just sort of giving you that feeling that there had been a lot there before. And it's almost wish they could have done a little even more with it. But, you know, we only had six parts.
Well, I mean, they could have cut the, you know, the doctor putting together the pile of crap on the wine bottle and gone to Atlantis an episode sooner.
Mm-hmm. It is a possibility. Yeah. And everybody's okay with throwing the Minotaur through the foam wall. We're kind of good with that one.
Yep.
That gave me my quota for goofy fight sequences.
The Doctor is Toreador. Come on, how is that goofy?
you know, Pertwee, they may have had something else, and Pertwee was like, no, this is what we're doing. I will say this, in remembering, you know, knowing that the Minotaur is in it, especially knowing, you know, who the actor is that played him, that it's Dave Prowse, who, you know, went on to be Darth Vader and stuff, but I didn't remember, frankly, honestly, how good the Minotaur looked, as silly as it sounds, because when you think about, if you think about Doctor Who and the Minotaur, John and I joke about Horns of Nymon all the time.
Yes.
And that's 10 years from, you know, in the future from this one, or 8 years. And the Nymon looked so much worse than the Minotaur in this episode did.
Yeah.
And I really like seeing that. And yeah, the foam wall thing, and, you know, that's just part of it. But I thought he was a much more convincing, you know, man beast than, granted, they were aliens and Horns of the Nymon, but still, you know, not those silly pantomime costumes.
Well, I'm assuming at this point the BBC had probably done several, you know, ancient Greek movies, you know, Greek gods, Hercules, all that kind of stuff. So they probably had a decent Minotaur head already in the basement.
That's a distinct possibility. What they didn't have, though, was Kronos.
Hey, clearly.
They had sheet and a hanger. It's fine.
No, I'm telling you. It was toilet paper rolls. So they basically TP'd an actor.
And
you think there was an actor in that?
And hung. Yes.
No, because that was clearly. No, they like made it out of. I think you're right. It was toilet paper. You know, they did the thing with the rubber band to make the head. And then they just put it on a string and dragged it around the room.
But there's the point where he's in Stu's lab, flapping around, just swinging back and forth on the cable, and just bumping into the scenery. And meanwhile, just trying to flap and scream. And I'm thinking, you know, watching Sesame Street, Mum and Shantz out there with a guy who just keeps kind of, you know, wheeling out the toilet paper and just, Haley, this is beyond you. This is way before your time. Sorry. Just run with us on this. It's actually hilarious if you knew it. But that's the balance. So you've got the Minotaur that looks.
You know what bothered me more than either of those things?
Hmm.
Stuart putting on a radiation suit with snaps and no gloves. Like, what's the point?
Well,
I was going to say, I did see an interesting. I watched the little documentary they have on the DVD called Between Now and Now. Where they talked to Barry Letts and Katie Manning, and they even had some good physicists on there. The guy that does, as soon as I saw him, I was like, wait, I know that guy from other stuff.
It's the guy who's not Brian Cox, yeah.
yeah. Jim, I think his name's Al Ishkili or something like that. But but in the talk about it, Barry Letts mentioned how he wanted Kronos to look more like more blue and more like fire, you know, a being of fire, but said that the director got in his head that nope, needs to be white like this big flapping chicken, something or other thing. And they probably should have listened to Barry.
Yeah. But I think that's indicative of what I absolutely love about the story is that, yes, it has some of the textbook things the classic Who tends to get, you know, just pinned to the wall over. The set's shaky. These costumes are hinky. I don't know what they did to Katie Manning's head when they, you know, put the bizarre wig on her that looked like everybody else's wig or what have you.
If we're going to talk about wigs, let's talk about the Atlantean wigs that look like they put three different wigs together.
Yes, well, because they used three different wigs.
Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah, they were learning from, you know, the roadies for Journey. And then they had some beehives left over, so they cut the tops off of the beehives.
Yeah, no, it's like the curly bits that go around the face, then the long wavy bit, and then like the ponytail from another wig on top of that.
Right. But the flat mullet at the back.
Yeah.
That keeps getting in keeps getting caught in your hands as you're gesticulating as you're speaking, but it has all those things that you could say, aha, okay, yeah, this is classic Who. This is the jokiness that I remember. But at the same time, there are some aspects within this script that are gold. You know, there are great moments with some of these characters. Especially when you talk about the Doctor's darkest day, and he goes through that dialogue. I mean, that still resonates. You know, it's this moment where all of a sudden everything slows down. All of the action, all the running around, all the fights, all the Venusian neck pinches and everything that's going on suddenly just pulls the e-brake, and we have this conversation of a daisy on a hillside that really strikes a great moment. And I think it speaks volumes about the Third Doctor and Joe relationship at this point. You know, they have become so, so symbiotic that they can have these conversations. And even as he's sharing this in all seriousness with her, and he's really trying to convey this very poignant story from his recollection, and he's sharing childhood memories. This is unprecedented for the Doctor. But all the while, she throws a little joke in there, and he picks up on the thread and jokes a little bit back and then goes back to the story. And it just, that's where their relationship is right now. It's as good as it gets.
Yeah, they're so just terrific together. And like I said, you can see how that's come from the experience together. And, also even the scene earlier on when they're driving in Bessie trying to get there, you know, early on in like episode two or so. And just sort of, you know, them, just that rapport that they have and have built up now, because we're at the end of their second season together. And it's, right. And that's why, you know, that's why whenever we think of, you know, doctors and their companions, we, you know, the Third Doctor and Joe, because they had that sort of relationship together, and there was so much caring, and it flowed between all the little easy ways that they related to each other. And that was a wonderful scene. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that whenever someone will question me on why do you like the old series, even with its shaky sets and dodgy plots, and I'll often point to the relationships between the Doctor and the companion and the characterizations really can get you through so much of that ostensibly terrible parts of the show. And this is definitely one of the highlights, that these scenes and that particular scene in particular is one of my favorites. I think that even though this is the first time I've seen it in context, it is one of my favorite scenes between a Doctor and a companion. And it sets up beautifully. The writer of this, Richard Sloman, writes Planet of the Spiders, and that scene pays off, you know, another season or two hence.
I'll also point out about this Robert Sloman script and Planet of the Spiders, that I was not aware of this, but as Barry Letts comes right out and says, like, literally the first thing in the little featurette, that anything written by Robert Sloman was written by Robert Sloman and Barry Letts, and that he co-wrote everything with him. And so, because Barry was very Buddhist, and they talk about the Doctor's Darkest Day scene has a little bit of that philosophy in it, and certainly Planet of the Spiders, it was, you know, all over the place.
Yeah.
In it. And, but it is, yeah, so interesting to see how they set that up and how that sort of, yeah, comes and flows through. But I think, yeah, a lot of that is probably Barry Letts too.
Absolutely. As far as getting into a little bit more of the ethereal and some of the abstract, we have the closing moments with Kronos. And I'm always a little fascinated by this. You know, we'll call it the Ingrid Bauer representation there, you know, as you got the big, the giant face confronting Joe, or should I say Jojo Grant. Jojo Grant and the doctor going over, you know, what to do with them, what to do with the master. The reverence shown to this eternal being really gives me something to chew on, you know, within the pantheon, because I know that there's, you know, you've got some written stories that sort of explore Kronos a little farther, you know, just because it's such a kind of a fascinating entity. But it almost led me to believe that there was a whole nother layer of this possible, you know, of these beings that either existed in, outside of, or transcended time, other than the Time Lords, who we are at this stage, we're still getting limited amount of information about, other than the fact that they were kind of oddly dressed jerks. You know, as far as we conveyed, who were basically using the Doctor as a thug to go around and do their bidding. But then there was this whole other scale of being, you know, these chronivores and so forth that we didn't really know if we were going to get anything more about. It was an interesting exploration into something that threw the whole perspective of the show into a new direction, or said that we had the possibility of starting to play around with not only the time manipulation, which they were starting to get a little bit more experimental with, as long as they stayed within the bounds, some sort of bounds of plausibility, so that it didn't just seem completely cockamamie. But there was, we now have the potential with a lot of these, with these time travel oriented stories, to put something either paranormal or supernatural into it as well, which just, you know, goes exponentially larger. I loved that. And I know it's the shape of things to come, but I can't imagine what this was doing to the viewing audience at the time.
I mean, I'll agree that it was tremendously interesting, you know, and it's different with, since we all saw it, like you were just mentioning, for anyone that had just, you know, it's 1972 and you see this for the first time and they all of a sudden bring this in, you know, we all have the benefit of so much history that we'd seen within Doctor Who since then. So we all know about Time Lords and mm-hmm. and so much information like that when we got there. But yeah, it was very fascinating too, just as a way to just to deal with the character of Kronos within the story, from something mm-hmm. that originally started as being this, it's a mad beast of time that he comes and eats everything and is literally the destroyer. And mm-hmm. then to show, you know, sort of that different aspect of her was really neat and fascinating. It's probably, you know, it is kind of too bad that they didn't go more into that, you know, in future years.
I will say, I mean, using, obviously, you know, we always like to enjoy the, I don't want to say practical explanations, but a Whovian explanation of something that was originally some sort of a legendary or mythological explanation, right? We're going to put Whovian science to explain previous, you know, magic and mystery. And that's always enjoyable too. But I think specifically seeing a creature or a being that even the Time Lords fear, or that have a power that even they can't. I mean, they were the sort of the top of the food chain to a certain degree, as far as we had known. I mean, we're our lowly Earthlings, and then we've got a couple of alien beings we've been introduced to who are a little bit further along than us. And then there's the Time Lords, who just have all that in spades, and then also have the ability to jump around, you know, chronologically, and so they have that advantage. So that you really just can't beat that. Oh wait, there's something else.
And Kronivore is too good of a name to waste.
Oh yeah.
Do these guys come back? Because that is a great name for a creature.
Only in some of the prose, I believe, or there might have been some comic use. But I know there were a couple of books that played with them. Kronos only appears in one other book, and then some comics grab a hold of it.
Yeah, and I agree. I think this sense of there being this greater universe, I think that's very appealing, especially looking back, as Will said, you know, when we now have a greater mythology of the Time Lords and so forth. But this, and from other media, that things have a fitting in some sort of multiverse. You know, this is probably, you know, I'm just trying to rack my brains, it's one of the few times, or first times, where you get that sense of that larger universe that would bring the Master to his knees immediately. And yeah, that's a really interesting scene. And I almost wish they played that out a little bit more, or had that greater sense of dread. You know, just to pick up on that just briefly, one of the things I liked about this episode a lot, or the story a lot, is how the Master goes from being entirely in control to not, like, losing all control and losing his ability to control events. And those moments where his hypnotism completely fails him is such a great scene. The way the actor who plays the King plays that off is brilliant. And the way Ingrid Potts plays it off at the same time, never forget I'm a queen, is beautiful. And Roger Delgado's reaction to that of trying, yes, I'm being calm, even though I'm fuming underneath, is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the way those sort of chinks come out of that armor in that multidimensional way is something we don't usually see with that character.
Very rapidly, too. I mean, he goes from having 5 1/4 episodes where he is thoroughly convinced that his plan has worked perfectly. I mean, he is getting everything that he has been aiming for.
Everything's coming up, Master.
Precise. And he's just reveling in it. And Delgado is just glowing through this. He's just great. They give him so much great screen time that you are willing to forgive the fact that, oh, look, it's another Dr. Master story. But this one feels very different because he's in the driver's seat for so long. And it dissolves so quickly. But I would say that it does not do so at a pace where you feel like, okay, they're just trying to wrap this up. With one caveat, and that's the, all right, you've won, I'll follow you into your TARDIS, but I'll be the last one to walk through the door. Quick, push and run! Push and run!
Push and run!
And then the Doctor and Joe are like, oh, what are you? It's like you almost were waiting for a laugh track or something. Like, oh, that Master got away. And it's kind of almost how they were all acting, you know, once they all got back to the lab and like, well, he foiled us again. And, you know, and
nope, it's that part of the script.
Yeah.
Three's Company ending.
Yeah. And I guess he'll be back next year, or almost like the old Super Friends Legion of Doom cartoons where the Super Friends beat them literally every week. But there's always something at the end when they're beaten and Lex Luthor presses a button and the Legion disappears to be back next week and lose again. You know, yeah. They're like, oh, but yeah, it certainly didn't feel abrupt or anything like that, except for, like you said, a little bit with the push at the end. But and Delgado is so good throughout this whole story. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, they give him so much to do, and it's some of the most fearsome and cruel that I remember seeing him. It's been a long time since I've seen some of his stories, but the part, I guess, at the end of episode 4, when he casts the Doctor out into the void, and then's like, "Yeah, I'm going to kill you too, Joe." And it's like, "Oh, okay." As much as he's charming, he's really nasty and mean. And okay, I remember why we look at him with such fear, and why they look at him with such fear.
Yeah. Absolutely. So it definitely reestablished the sinister, or the ruthless nature of the Master in that one. While at the same time, you know, you get the goofiness of Baby Benton and everything. So
did we miss an opportunity to have the Brig doing like 3 men and a baby with Baby Benton?
Yeah, we kind of did. We kind of did. That would have been something.
I would have watched that show. But can we also talk about how awesome Jo is in this episode? Because I think she is, like, especially at the end, in terms of she's the one who solved everything by pushing the time ramp forward.
Yeah.
Being fearless, absolutely, and willing to sacrifice when the Doctor probably wasn't.
Yes. Well, it clearly wasn't. His hesitation was absolutely transparent about saying, oh, I'm giving you one last chance. That absolutely is not the case. I mean, the Master had him absolutely pegged. He was, you know, it was his greatest weakness being, you know, his adoration and his affection for this pathetic human. But this pathetic human is the one whose adoration and admiration for her partner in time is the catalyst to bring about the solution. So it's just it's a beautiful statement.
And she's, you know, she's so fearless throughout the whole thing. She's, you know, as soon as she's listening in to the conversation in the amazing scene between the master and Galea, and she hears what they're trying to do, she's like, you know, tells Lachis or whatever her name is, you know, you go get help. I am going into the labyrinth. Like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, she'll just dive headlong. And even out when they first get the doctor's TARDIS after Yates almost gets blown up, you know, she's like, of course she's going with the doctor. And there's no, Joe, no, this is too dangerous. She's, you know, especially at this point, their relationship, we're long since past that. And exactly, it's nice that the doctor doesn't, and that they don't insult us, the audience, and the doctor doesn't try and insult Joe by going, now, Joe, it's too dangerous. Like, no, you're right. Come on. Let's go. Let's do this. But yeah, she was just, she got tons to do with this, which is great. And part of why, you know, she's such a great companion.
Have to agree. So, all right, we always like to make sure that we sort of bookend these conversations about the classic episodes to talk about the rewatchability and the recommendability of them on whatever scale you choose to use, whether it's a 5-star system or whether it's a temperature control or I don't really know whatever the heck point of reference you want to use. Haley, as far as your exposure as your realm of Pertwee knowledge expands, where would you rate this one on the rewatchability? I'm pretty sure I know where you're going to come from on this one, but the recommendability is actually a pretty key one.
I really enjoyed this one. Like, I really enjoyed watching it. I thought it was a lot of fun, but except for the scene between Joe and the doctor where he's talking about his darkest day, I don't know how critical it would be to get this story in particular,
okay,
going forward.
All right. Will, how about you?
You know, I would say as far as rewatchable, absolutely. Like I said, it's the first time I'd seen it in a long time and found myself really, really enjoying it too. John and I were texting over the weekend and we were, you know, first, like, Roger Delgado couldn't be having more fun. I love the way you put it, Kier, when you said he was glowing, because he really was. He was given so much to do and so much more than he normally got to do, as much as he got to pretend to be this type of character and that type of character. He got, you know, the scene with him and Galea is, you know, works on a lot of levels.
Oh, yeah.
So rewatchability, definitely. I mean, I do agree that it's not the most vital in the sense of, I wouldn't call it the greatest story ever, but especially to just appreciate and enjoy Roger Delgado, that right there, I would recommend it for that. And it is such an encapsulation of Pertwee era Who and all its good and bad things that, you know, I would probably recommend it just because it's fun and it's got a lot going for it. And there's a lot of things where you go, you know, like as we've talked about Kronos, amongst other things, where you just sort of slap your head. So I would give it a thumbs up on both, actually.
Okay. All right. John?
It's funny that there's that reference in this series about, and this story about time being a collection of nows, now, because this is such a story that is a collection of some really fantastic moments surrounded by some really terrible moments, I think, in my opinion. If I were to tell you this is essentially, you know, the Doctor facing off against the Master, Countess Dracula, and Darth Vader for the fate of Atlantis and time itself, you'd expect a certain sort of story, which you wouldn't necessarily get here. I think if you watch Doctor Who for a plot that hangs together and makes sense, not the story for you. If you watch it for interesting characters interacting well and really fun moments, then I think this is definitely a story worth watching. And particularly as it relates to spoiler, you know, there's that great moment that relates down the road, I think is definitely worth watching. So I'm sort of, you know, 5 out of 10 on both, I guess. You know, it's something if it came on again, I would watch because it's fun, but I wouldn't necessarily go out of my way for.
Okay. All right. I have to agree with everyone on the rewatchability. I would actually probably consider the rewatchability to be a bit stronger, maybe than 5 out of 10 in that regard, because I think once you've seen it, going back and seeing it again and being cognizant of some of the moments that are upcoming or the nature of the conversations that are being had, you tune into some things that you may get some fuller appreciation on subsequent rewatches. recommendability. I still want to consider this as one that I would say this is like a tier two. This is not what I would consider to be the mandatory set, but I would not put it as far as a tier three. If it's on, sure. I would say this is one that, you know, if you're really kind of looking to get a fuller appreciation of the master, if you want a fuller and just his capability, as we've been talking about, you know, sort of the reestablishment of his true villainy. He's not just a mustache twirler. He's got some real darkness to him. He is an actual threat. He is a mortal risk. And obviously just the Dr. Joe relationship just gets better and better and better and better. So, and your supporting cast is really enjoyable too. So I wouldn't make that necessarily anything towards the recommendability to it, but it's not going to detract you by any means. Unit is great throughout. I mean, I'm big pro Benton. I probably enjoy Benton more than I do Yates. Sorry, Yates fans. I
know you're out there.
Sorry, Richard. But yeah, so I would absolutely say so. And again, I know we've been discussing this, the DVD extras, as always, are always golden. There are a couple that come along with this one. There's the, obviously, as we mentioned, the time between, or between now and now. But there's another, I believe, that you actually get on the bonus that shows you, some of the restoration efforts that went into this particular story to make Kronos even more glowy, white, flappy, or however they did it. So for a couple of minutes of enjoyment in that regard as well. So please do. We typically take our news segment and use it as a separate conversation from what we do as a little bit of an additional conversation. We usually have something that we want to sort of dive into a little bit further. This week, it happens to emerge from a news segment because I believe it deserves to stand on its own. As we were gearing up for this week's recording, the BBC decided that Sunday was too slow of a news day. And dropped an Instagram photo, I think, at the start. I just, you know, threw out this nice, yeah, here's a nice picture. Oh, here's, you know, Jodie Whittaker. We love seeing her because she's amazing and she's beautiful and she's 13th Doctor and she's going to be legendary and all these wonderful things. Oh, and by the way, she's got some new friends. Meet the new TARDIS team. Ha ha, bye. And they just run off giggling, you know, back into their offices and the internet collapses. What do we know other than the fact that we have to give the Mirror credit again?
I can hear Kier gagging. Can you guys hear that?
I can, actually. That's so strange. Are you okay, Kier?
I feel like I ate a duck dinner and it's just there's this greasy feeling in my stomach a little bit.
Is duck the right bird you're thinking of?
Yeah. Yeah. Crow, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some sort of fowl. So Bradley Walsh, in there as... But I want to... Has everyone taken apart the official press release and sort of read this through?
They're very sort of vague with everything, aren't they?
Yeah. The word companion does not show up once. Not once. Friends. So, yeah. Team. Yeah, I could say, well, it's a team insofar as they are all part of the cast.
Yeah.
That's a team.
All these people coming aboard the TARDIS.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at this. We're being loose with our phrasing. Because they know at this point, we're devouring semantics as if they had cheese on them. But So to break it down for the folks that have been, you know, just emerging from their coma, you know, welcome is 2017, you know, just don't look at the political landscape. It's going to be okay. But just let's focus on sci-fi for right now. We're going to be all right. As we said, we've got Bradley Walsh, who's got a character named Graham. That's about as far as we've really taken it. Tosin Cole with a character named Ryan. And Mendy Gill coming in to play Yasmin. They make a passing mention of Sharon Clarke's returning role, but they don't really delve too far into that one. But what do any of you know about the body of work from these three actors who we're now going to get to know a lot better?
Before we get into that, remind me who Sharon Clarke was.
The fourth person they mentioned in the article.
Okay, yes. But they say it's a returning role as if it's somebody we've seen before.
No, I took it to mean it's going to be a recurring role.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, it's of a lesser frequency.
Okay.
Probably.
Yeah. I just, returning made me think returning to a role that she had played on the show before.
No, meaning just other than a one-off.
Not a regular. Yeah. Gotcha.
Correct.
It was shocking kind of to me seeing that because I watch lots of British TV and I'm always joking about whenever I watch a new show with British actors in it, I have to, it takes me a minute or two. They go, oh, okay, I know that person from Midsummer Murders or the episode of Doctor Who or from this other thing. I don't watch Game of Thrones.
So you're the one.
I know. I am the one.
Oh, cool. me too, actually.
Yeah. Here, kick them off the podcast.
But they are three actors that I have not ever seen in anything. So, and I guess maybe part of it's because they're on, they've been on, I know that Tosin and Mandip have been on one of the soaps, either EastEnders or Hollyoaks, or Hollyoaks is Australian, isn't it? That's completely wrong.
No, yeah, EastEnders is essentially the Law and Order of the BBC. You know, everybody has to go through there at one point.
I was going to say, I'm scrolling through IMDb pages now, and Sharon Clarke has been in EastEnders.
Yes.
But, and the other two, I guess, are regulars on stuff. But yeah, I don't know anything about them. I know Bradley Walsh has been around forever and has been a game show host.
Game show
as
host,
well as an actor.
And comedian. Yeah.
And probably known also to Mr. Chibnall from Law & Order UK because he was playing the Sam Waterston role, I think, on the British version.
And Law and Order brings everything together. It is the Kevin Bacon of television.
So absolutely. So Bradley Walsh does have priors with Jim, like Jodie Whittaker did. And, you know, I've seen clips from Law and Order UK because he also appeared with Freema Agyeman, who was on that as well. He's a really good actor on top of being a comedian and a game show host. And his, you know, if you get a chance, a lot of his stuff on the game show does appear on YouTube. So you can check those out.
Right. Right. Unfortunately, I will say that there is actually a sour note, to the release because it does provide the concrete confirmation about what they're doing to the episode length and episode count for the season. So that's a little bit painful because we were getting the impression from, again, some of the tabloid rumors that were circling around when they started getting word of some of the changes that we were in store for, that yes, we were going to be getting fewer episodes, but the thought was, okay, but they're going to be slightly longer episodes, so doesn't that mean we're going to get roughly around the same amount of screen time? Doesn't prove to be the case. So now we're still looking at, you know, roughly 50-minute episodes with the exception of the premiere, but we're down to 10. So, and I'm assuming they're not counting the Christmas episode into that because they never officially do count that into the season. So 10 plus one.
And that seems a shame. And I wonder if that is a budgetary issue or, you know, some way to make the budget last, you know, have better episodes and more special effects.
It's a really good question. I think that's actually something that's going to come up quite a bit now that this is officially sort of, you know, on the books and everybody knows about it. They're not, you know, it's not the undiscussed topic. I'm sure it's going to come up quite a bit in convention panels and subsequent interviews with Chibnall and Company and so forth and sort of hash out the rationale behind it. BBC One is never always that forthcoming with some of their rhyme or reason, but I would imagine that if the rest of the production crew is privy to the rationale behind it, they'll feel comfortable in saying, all right, no, well, this was, it's strictly down to money, folks. You know, this is the show is a business. We've got a budget. We got to keep within parameters. It's a money thing. We're going to make sure that every 50 minutes that we give you is going to be the best 50 minutes possible. Don't worry your pretty little heads about that. But we just got to make sure, you know, at the end of the day, somebody's got to watch the wallet. So, and we'll accept it begrudgingly, but, you know, nonetheless, we have to. We'll take everything that we'll get. So,
maybe this is just me, but it seems like Chibnall is probably a more serialized type of writing person.
Oh, by all means.
So no, maybe the idea he has for a story has 10 beats, which is why the season has 10 episodes.
Yeah.
And I wonder, too, if given how much we've read and heard about him potentially doing some sort of writer's room sort of idea or a different writing setup, if it's one of those where he's like, look, I've done this and I can only do, you know, it's kind of, they're kind of all kind of be Chris Chibnall episodes. And so he's like, I can only kind of really do 10 or 10 is what works or, you know, and just given to the time that they spend on each episode, it's just like, this is all we can do, I guess.
And is he going to continue running Broadchurch while doing Doctor Who?
Broadchurch is done.
Broadchurch is over. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. He called that one done. He basically kind of ran the story out to what he considered to be the close on that. And I think most of the fans looked at it and said, yeah, I think the story has kind of done itself. It's had its opportunity. Speaking about the writer's room theory, because there really wasn't a whole lot. I mean, the discussion came up quite a while back, and then it sort of ran silent for a little while, and every once in a while it would kind of bump back up again, and it was, for the most part, a lot of the conversation was going on stateside, saying, I wonder if he's, you know, if that rumor was true about him going to more of a, you know, an American-style writer's room. Well, we had a panel discussion about this back at Regen, who in Baltimore back in March, we had Robert Shearman on the panel with us. And he was actually, he opened my eyes to quite a bit. We'll have to make sure that we get the audio out to you. We'll do a little little extra episode release because we did hold on to that conversation. But he was talking about the fact that strictly from a cost perspective, a writer's room is not a great idea. Because of the logistics involved with getting all of your writers in from who knows where and who knows when in order to collaborate on these things. And then it slows down the creative process rather than getting script submissions, subsequent edits, resubmissions, and finalizations. It becomes a myriad of steering corrections along the way. And he was saying that in a lot of showrunners' perspectives, at least on the British side of the aisle, so to speak, that they believe that it stifles the creativity of a single writer to be able to be a true storyteller, because at that point you're part of a much larger mindshare, and it breaks some of what makes Doctor Who really enjoyable in the variety program aspect of one script after another. It has such a different feel when Toby Whithouse is in there, and then Sarah Dollard grabs a hold of a script, and then you've got Paul Cornell in there adding his prowess, and everything just has a flavor that you worry about the homogeny of it, that a writer's room would to a certain degree cause that bleed. So it really was a fascinating conversation, and I'll absolutely make sure that we get that shared. But I was prepared for the entire panel conversation to go, really gonna, this is what we're gonna do. And he just basically pooped on our picnic table and said, no, there's very good viability that this is not going to happen. Because we had actually, as he was saying, we had thought about it back for season one, and Davies and company said, no, this is not what we want to do for this litany of reasons. And those reasons still to a certain degree stand. So I'm fascinated to see what's going to happen.
Yeah. And after hearing all that and the way you relayed how Rob put it, that makes a lot of sense, and that we wouldn't want to see that and I'm sure Chris Chibnall would probably go, oh, I don't want to have to come up with 10 completely different stories unless he has one big sort of serialized idea. And that would be a huge, and even within that, you know, it seems like, even if it's like, we're doing the Key to Time 2, and it still would need to be, you know, 10 different stories in a sense, or how many ever. So yeah, that's going to be one of the fascinating things. Do we know when they're starting filming soon?
I don't,
there were rumors that they were starting read-throughs today. And with filming to begin fairly shortly, although for an autumn release, that seems still pretty early. I do want to say one thing about the writer's room, though, is that, you know, I think I agree that one of the things that makes Doctor Who unique is that sort of variety approach. But at the same time, if you are going to do
a season long arc. Like, let's say it's The Doctor Exiled on Earth, like part two, right? A writer's room does make sense if that's going to be your approach, because then you can hammer out those beats and so forth. And then the other thing to note is that every person who's ever played the Doctor since the relaunch has said what a grind it is. Yeah. And you know, and this is just—I definitely don't think this is some sort of just in case, you know, any sort of sexist thing where it's, you know, I don't think Jodie Whittaker can handle it. I think she definitely could. But I think if she ever talked to David Tennant about his experiences playing the Doctor, he would say what a physical toll it took on him, considering he had to have a back operation just to finish up, you know, his tenure. So I can imagine that there is something to maybe limiting the amount of work that the main actor has to do, which may also explain why they have three friends, not companions, as well, to shoulder the burden on that.
And Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi both had the same knee injury.
The knee injury,
Yeah, I was just thinking about that story, too, where, like, yeah, Capaldi said, yeah, I saw Matt Smith, and they were, like, each pointed at each other's knee, and like, oh, you see now. We've got the same thing.
Yeah, no 90-degree turns at a full run. It's just bad, bad for the wheels. All right. Well, As I said, this is almost as new to us as any other item we could possibly be discussing tonight. But it's the shape of things to come. And just to add one point, if you're kind of curious to think where are they along the laying out the grid for the production blocks and things of that sort, I can only recommend going out and seeking following on Twitter your set designers and costumers, because they are the ones who give you kind of some of the clearest indications about where they are in the pipeline at any given moment. I mean, we found the same thing during the last series, keeping contact with Haley Neubauer and all the things she was doing from the costume department, which was not only just fascinating to see the work that she was doing, but just to be able to sort of get a sense of the frantic pace that they were working at to meet their production block deadlines on each set of 2 to 3 stories that they were working on at a time. So just a little pro tip there for super fans.
And there's another explanation you just gave right there that maybe everyone said, hey, do we really, you know, they're probably like, do we need to do 12? And they're probably starts going, wow, we would love to not do 12. As much as we all fans like we can, you know, we're scrambling, you know, it's one of those where, you know, we're running to hand it used to be a video cassette, or we're trying to, you know, get the new episode uploaded and it airs in 3 minutes or something, where, you know, to give everybody a little bit more time to breathe and get everything more completed. I mean, granted, they always have the season pretty much done before it airs, but still it's such a grind that maybe that all factors into it too. And they're like, you know, we can only do, if you only want to use us 2 or 3, 4 costumers or, you know, or the effects teams or whatever, you know, we, you know, just give us 20% less to do.
I will counter with, we gave those jerks a whole year off. They could give us 12 episodes.
What have you been doing all this time?
I agree with Haley.
Just to keep it balanced. All right. Well, a couple of news items for the night. Let's get through these. I'm gonna flip the order on these for my own personal reasons, but I know that we all came to realize that we were horribly wrong about how much we were going to enjoy or not enjoy Matt Lucas's Nardole character in the past series. We thought it was going to be kind of a brief stint. It turned out to be a much longer run for the character. We weren't really sure how much we were going to be endeared to him. We found that we were, you know, tremendously endeared to him by the time all was said and done. Now our suppositions about whether we have seen the last of Nardole may be incorrect as well.
If he's not running a black market next time we see him.
Well, I guess according to the conversation that he had with the kids over at Den of Geek, it was you know, saying that the program still remains, as he says in a quote, a big part of my life. What I'm interpreting on this may be a little bit of creative license, because I have any reason to believe that he might be conversing with folks from Big Finish, of which I think he would be fantastic. I mean, he's got a very recognizable voice and would carry really well in audio, or whether it even may just be a matter of, you know, when he says my relationship with the show, well, it could be any number. Yeah, it's just I'm in the bushes, spotted around Cardiff, hiding in bins. But does it mean necessarily that Nardole's character will return on screen? I don't know. There's also the fact that think about some of our last couple Doctor transitions. There have been the moments that are the reflective flashbacks as far as a way that they're conveyed on screen, but they're actually done by shooting some additional footage with previous actors to help with that bridge. So it could mean a lot of things. He could just be toying with it because he's learning to take a page from the Book of Moffat and screw with people on semantics.
That's his like his graduate level project for Moffat. Okay, Matt, you've been fantastic. One more thing for you to do.
Yeah, your job is not yet complete here. So, but I mean, I'd be glad to take it in any format because, as I said, I think we all came around to really kind of enjoy the character. I was pleasantly surprised to enjoy Nardole as much as I did once I realized, okay, this is a touchstone for classic Whovian characters or classic Whovian viewers to have a character that kind of thinks or sort of approaches some aspects of New Who the way a classic Whovian would. And here's a character who actually articulates that and throws it right at the Doctor in a very classic Whovian way. And from that point on, I totally get it. And our last item to put in the news roster is one that I think is a great point of laud and adoration for the show as I think a well-earned award that has been handed to the program from the Pink News Awards that gave recognition to Doctor Who for its dedication to LGBT inclusiveness. So this is, for obvious reasons, we've been discussing this all through the past season and even prior. But I think really culminating in the treatment of the Bill Potts character, it really shows that the LGBT. Sorry, I'm tired here. I'm in the wrong time zone right now. I am 3 hours off my sleep.
Yeah, Kier's usually in bed by now.
I am, and Haley's just mocking me.
We should record it this time all the time. This is working great for me.
Yeah, that'd be great. But the show has just has really moved things forward very progressively and for absolute good reason. From cast to crew to script to concept, I'm extremely pleased about this, and I know I'm not alone. Are we at a point where we feel... obviously, there's always room for growth. There's always room for growth, but do we feel that the leap forward that we've had within the most recent span for the program is something that has been audience driven, has been showrunner driven? You know, as could be a possibility. Is it a matter of they felt that, you know, we've been waiting for the opportunity to be able to do this, and now we've had writers that have given us that empowerment? Where do we want to attribute a lot of this inclusiveness that has now gotten to the level where it's earning these accolades?
I think it's just, you know, it's the time in our society when they felt they could do it without being panned for it, and... Mm. It's probably something that anywhere along the way, there have been showrunners that wanted to do something like this, and they just couldn't because the time they were in was not going to accept it. But that's not where we are anymore. We're now at a time where it's not only accepted, but almost expected that you're going to have a character that's going to be representative.
Mm. Or that they were taking some sort of that if they had waited any longer, they would have taken even further criticism for saying, why aren't you giving an accurate representation of the populace that is your viewing audience?
Yeah, yeah. And that's some of that is part of the problem with how Doctor Who is structured is if you're only going to have two characters, then it's hard to have a lot of representation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree with that. I think it's a combination of all of the above. I mean, at one level, yes, the showrunners do have to take that step, you know, but it's a step that, you know, it has to be done at a certain point because it has to reflect society. I think, you know, one of the things Will and I will sometimes say on our podcast is, you know, you're watching a show about someone traveling through time and space in a box that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, and that a character is gay is your problem. You know, that to us just seems frankly more bizarre than anything. And so I think it's probably, you know, in one way it's long since time to have a companion, you know, have those attributes be that kind of person. And I think, I would have said before this year that it also took a showrunner who had the trust of the BBC and had the political capital to do that. You know, it's one of the things I don't think a Moffat would have felt he could have done the first season, perhaps. But, you know, at the same time, Chris Chibnall right out of the gate cast a female doctor. So a female actress as the doctor. So, you know, I think it's time for change, and I'm pretty happy with it myself.
Yeah, I'll just agree with what they say. I mean, I think it's definitely a combination of things, but I think we can all be proud with that. If you would have said, like John said, not just Moffat having the political capital to do it, and also, you know, maybe being, you know, in his last season, he feels more comfortable that, you know, I want to take a chance with this. But let's be honest, if you would have said 3 or 4 years ago that Stephen Moffat is going to write this character, you know, and create this character, you wouldn't necessarily be as confident that it was going to turn out the way it did. And it turned out great. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, maybe that's all some of us, and maybe even it's just me trying to project, you know, selling, you know, Moffat short, but I think it shows, you know, the growth of him as a writer and being more respectful and aware of, like you said, of changes in the audience demographic. And it's just time. But it was, you know, great to see how well it was done. And of course, finding someone as wonderful as Pearl Mackey, you know, that really, really helped it too. But it was, you know, it was just everything sort of fit, you know, right time, right place, right actor. You know, and even the BBC having to go along with it to a degree that, yeah, all good.
Yeah. Yep. So, well, let's just hope that they continue forward with identifying what it is the time for, you know, and we've got plenty of opportunities to be able to move things forward equally progressively. And it's just going to get better as we go. When we convene, we've got on the more distant horizon, when we reconvene for our next classic rewatch, we're into the good stuff now.
As opposed to this garbage we've watched up to this point.
No. At this point, it just becomes. You had your dessert, and then somebody comes around with cotton candy, and you're like, oh yes, please. So we'll have the three doctors. So that's absolutely something to enjoy. But for next week, we wanted to have a little bit of a meta conversation. Haley, you're getting more and more accustomed to these things at this point. But where we're going to be talking about how Whovian podcasts like ours are keeping the conversations going during these ploddingly long downtimes between main show broadcasts.
Years.
Forever.
You definitely did a good job in not having us here for that conversation next week, since we're one of the podcasts that, yeah, we took another break. You know, that's how we handle it.
Shut the lights down. See you in a few months, everybody. I know, but we'll actually be merging our TARDIS with that of the powers of this week in time travel. So we'll have Chip Sutterth and Alyssa Franken, familiar voices and friends of ours. So we figured we'd just have a big old podcast love fest next week.
Yeah, because I've never talked to you and Alyssa about podcasting before.
Nah. No one would ever listen to that garbage. But speaking of listening to podcasts that are not pure garbage, gentlemen, when you reconvene, and I know you will be reconvening soon because we're coming up on what is normally, I guess you kind of use this as one of your opportunities to pull the cover off the DeLorean and get going, for LI Who. Where do we get more Mutter Spiral?
This is totally John Steele.
This is, well, you can definitely check us out on iTunes and wherever podcasts are sold for free. You can download us there. We also have a Facebook page, the Mutter Spiral podcast page, and on Twitter you can check him out. He runs the Mutter Spiral with a single S. Someone is still squatting on Mutter Spiral with two S's, right?
Yeah. I need to check. I check it every 3 or 4 months, and it's still there. So yeah, one of these. But now it's to the point where it would be confusing. I don't know. I'm sure it's easy to do, but yeah, I'll have to check it again.
We're looking forward to being at Long Island Who, where we'll be doing our usual podcasts and interviews with people who are there and whoever we can sweet talk into talking with us. And you know, Alyssa and Chip are both friends of ours as well, and they will, I'm sure, do a fantastic job when you merge the TARDISes and have your own meta time RAM next week.
Excellent. And I did ping you gentlemen both about considering a little bit of game show appearance when you're there, if the schedule allows. Okay. Because it's going to get a little weird. So we want everyone to share in the weirdness. But thank you both for spending the evening chatting with us. It's been an absolute pleasure having you.
Hey, thanks so much for including us. It's I know it's been my pleasure, and I'll let John speak for himself, but yeah, it's a lot of fun.
It's definitely been a pleasure for me, and I've definitely enjoyed it. And it was a great opportunity to watch this show story that I haven't seen. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Anytime. We'll be glad to have you back. I was waiting for John to say, and it hasn't been a pleasure for me. It was actually droning and painful. I just wanted to balance things out. It sucked. So
that's my line.
Exactly. So, well, this has been episode 256 of Gallifrey Public Radio. So until next week, this is Kier saying, so someone just please keep me informed. Let me know when Funko starts offering the Baby Benton figures, because I'm all over that like white on rice.
And this is Haley saying, I'm sorry about your coccyx too, Mr. Hansen.
Oh, you had to play the tailbone joke, didn't you?
Yep.
Ah, you jerk.
Right here at the tail end of the podcast.
Oh, the hits keep coming, kids. I don't see everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
You suck, Mally.